Yes.
Anyway, hello everyone, my name is Matthew Brown. So what I'm doing today is introducing this event. I'm to introduce my two dear colleagues, Patrick McGuinness, who's been in Oxford even longer than I have, and writes in an academic, perhaps you'll know already, but anyway I'll say, writes in an academic vein, mainly about 19th century French poetry and theatre. Writes poems. Has written a novel, The Last 100 Days, which came out 2 years ago. Has written a memoir, Other People's Countries, which has just come out, about... I'm not sure how long you spent in your hometown, that is your hometown, even though you are the...
Too long.
Yeah, it's too long, even though it wasn't... Anyway, growing up in a... Semi-growing up in a small Belgian town. The kinds of writing that he's going to be talking about today, he does himself practice, so among his own poems are pseudo-translations, as they tend to be called, and he's also translated in a less pseudo way, but pseudo is not really the right word for any of these things, because I think you're going to talk about Mallarmé for Franatol's tomb, for instance, very beautiful translations of that. Our other speaker is Adriana Jacobs, who's joined Oxford Cambridge last year from Yale, who works mainly on modern Hebrew poetry, but is going to be talking about American poetry today. And I haven't heard or read nearly as much of Adriana's work as I would like to, but in a sense, so far as I understand, part of the point of it is the multilingualism of, you know, the modern Hebrew poetry is inherently multilingual, kind of shaded and diverse by the languages, so the kind of boundaries one erects around national languages are, you know, not very applicable in that case. Perhaps they're not very applicable really. And then Kasia is going to respond. So I think is Adriana going first?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. I'll go first.
Adriana's going first. Patrick's going to say something. Kasia, who's a graduate student working across English and Polish and German translational poetry. So you have some brief and thought-provoking response. And then we'll break and have some drinks and things, and then we'll kind of reconvert.
Is my handout circular? I have a handout of three poems, and it mostly for illustrative purposes, as I think will be clear when I talk. But I'm happy in the Q&A to talk some more about it. So as Matthew said, most of my everyday teaching and research is in the field of modern Hebrew and Israeli poetry. But as someone who's also deeply interested in translation history and theory and studies, I always find it really useful to step out of those zones and look at what's going on in other literary linguistic fields. And I find the American zone to be particularly interesting and inspiring. And this talk sort of reflects some of my reading of contemporary American poet translators, whose work pushes me to think about Hebrew and Israeli poetry and translation in very different ways. So the title is Rogue Translation. In his book on translation, Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Everything, David Bellows has a chapter titled Beating the Bounds, What Translation Is Not. For Bellows, the practice of beating the bounds illustrates the importance of keeping certain limits in check in the process of translation. He observes, and I quote, "One of the sides of translation is as unbounded as the line of a shore. Tides rise and fall, and coasts can change shape, but other boundaries are clearly marked. Translation does not extend in every direction. Its own field is quite large enough," end quote. But even Bellows concedes that borders create gray areas, and his comments also suggest that to the extent that a perimeter marks an area of ownership, it also establishes the limits of ownership, limits that can be pushed against, pushed through, and even transgressed. Whereas Bellows approaches the idea of translation with caution and restraint, though he allows for this one sort of unbounded line, the American poet and publisher Joyelle McSweeney doesn't hesitate to apply force. Here's how she describes her creative process. "My process is to collect phrases and yoke them by violence together, forcing them into such extreme pressures that they buckle and release unholy noises." But what does it mean to yoke phrases and words together by violence? Does this violence imply that there is a nonviolent way that words hold together, a natural, painless, normative, peaceful grammar that this yoking undermines. McSweeney, whose publishing house Action Books promotes translations that, to quote from their website, if taken internally may break apart societal forms, end quote, also has an interest in extremophiles, creatures that live in environments that otherwise would seem inhospitable to life. For example, certain microbes that can survive extreme cold, fish that live in extreme ocean depths in a state of blindness, bacteria that thrive in extreme heat. But again, the very category of the extremophile exists because a state of equilibrium exists where most organisms thrive. And this is what makes the extremophile such a productive metaphor for language in McSweeney's view. Are there words like extremophiles, she seems to inquire, words that survive in extreme juxtapositions, extreme punning, extreme polysemy, extreme intertextuality? And what does this kind of extremity look like on the page? How does one write this in a state of the extreme? The space of translation can be understood to be such an extreme, a space where extreme pressure pushes a word, a text, toward and beyond a breaking point. But translators generally acknowledge this. The moment that a word begins that movement into another language, it faces, enters, and attempts to cross that space that the Canadian poet and translator Ann Carson has described as that gap between the word you're at and the word you can't get to. This gap is lawless. It has no rules, no map, no compass. But isn't the act of writing, as McSweeney indicates, also tempted to push readers to this gap? Isn't this what good writing is always already doing? It's no wonder that discourses on translation over centuries have come up with so many unflattering metaphors for translation. Translation as loss, infidelity, translation as a rogue, to name a few. But if we agree with Octavio Paz that writing and translating are twin processes, then these unflattering metaphors should apply to original texts as well. The demand for fidelity, obedience, and lawfulness persists in critiques of translation. But a text in translation is rarely content to be domesticated. More often than not, it strays, moves, changes. It enters that gap between languages and emerges in a variety of guises, re-entering the polite society of the target language with none of us the wiser. Outwardly, this kind of translation knows how to behave, to play by the rules. But what mischief has it been up to? What mischief will it be up to? What has a translator had to do to keep such a translation in line? Reviewers who fall back on the cliche of the adeptly or elegantly translated text have been taken in by a facade. In the hours after Gabriel Garcia Marquez's death was announced, Facebook walls and Twitter streams circulated the line, many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. Gregory Rabassa's elegant English translation of the opening line of Cien Años de Soledad, one of the representative works of the Latin American boom, entered the English language literary economy in 1970 like a live grenade, something that I think reviewers and even readers tend to forget. Translating poetry is a generative and creative practice, arguably synonymous with the act of writing itself. But it also confuses the lines between author and translator, translation and original, in ways that are playful and mischievous, while also problematic and dangerous. The slippages that occur between translation and poetic invention have made translation an appealing enterprise for poets across various languages and historical traditions. And even poets who are not translators engage translation as an act synonymous with poetic invention, even as a guise for original writing. But pseudo-translations are not mere masks, and here I'm sort of anticipating Patrick's talk a bit. Rather, these translation strategies, tools, and tactics constitute not only the rich intertextual layers of a poem, but also its translatability. That is how a poem moves out of a page, from lips to lips, in the words of the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. In 1964, at a comparative literature conference that took place in Switzerland, the Hebrew poet and translator, Leah Goldberg, whose work has been deeply important to me, observe that poets who translate are rarely interested in following the law of the original text letter, and the translations that result when poets translate other poets often lie on the borderline, this is her phrase, between original writing and translation. Here Goldberg is thinking about the ways in which good translations can create transformative change within a literary culture, but her comments also touched on an area that has made poetic translation a deeply suspect translation activity. The spaces around a border not only constitute interstitial third spaces, but also what emerges or materializes as a limit is pushed and prodded, as it resists and yields, so that translation enacts and embodies, in the words of Deleuze and Guattari, a movement of language towards its extremes, toward a reversible beyond or before. The operative crucial word here, of course, is reversible. Wherever poetic translation goes, it can also come back. But how do translators push themselves beyond this borderline, this limit, and this extreme? There's no shortage of blueprints for drawing up proper translations, but violent, transgressive, rogue translations chart their own path. In recent years, the translation turn taken by English language poets has coincided with critical considerations of the global dominance of English and the politics of English language translation. And these issues have preoccupied contemporary American poet translators like David Cameron, Christian Hockey, and Sawako Nakayasu, who engage translation playfully, critically, politically, not only as a process synonymous with writing, but also as a practice that problematizes the cultural and linguistic politics of global English through their appropriation, rewriting, and outright theft. Through their work, among others, these varied approaches to translation have proliferated in recent years in the United States, by and large via the efforts of independent publishers and small press distributors. Take, for example, Cameron's exuberant translations of Charles Baudelaire's Les Fleurs du Mal, and that's the first page of the handout. Originally titled Flurries of Mail, Cameron's The Flowers of Bad was published in 2007 by Ugly Duckling Press, an independent publisher based in Brooklyn. And this was with a collaboration with a sort of oddly named press, Unbelievable Alligator. Cameron, who studied French in high school and university, calls these false translations because, in his words, they do not intend to honor the literal meaning of Baudelaire's poem. And I think that's evident from the selection I gave you. But the expression Flowers of Bad is hardly a false translation. In fact, it is a hyper-literal translation of Les Fleurs du Mal. So already in the very title, Cameron is subverting and parroting the relation between fidelity and literality in translation. The Flowers of Bad also calls to mind the English expression a bad seed, a being genetically predisposed toward bad, lawless behavior. But this raises the question, is there something in the original text that engenders these bad translations, a kind of rotten quality, a chromosomal glitch that's lurking to be expressed in the process of translation? The process here, arguably more than the results, is what fascinates us. In an afterword to the book, Cameron discusses some of the different methods he used to produce his translations of Baudelaire, and there's really nothing good about them. In one instance, he wrote a poem on a sheet of glass and smashed it with a hammer, observing how and in what state the shards scattered. These fragments and their recombination form one of his translations. This approach is heretical to any consideration of translation proper. But what it does is call attention to practices that have been long-standing in translation, like the translation and indeed rewriting of sapphic fragments, and also the long tradition of pseudo-translation. It makes us think of the original text as a material organic object that decays over time, not only in an archival sense, but also in terms of the continued viability of its language and reception. In an essay titled Shnei Nofim, Two Views, the Hebrew poet Avot Yeshurun argued in favor of this kind of textual damage. And this is an essay that was published in the 1970s. He writes, "For a writer, language is like a child's toy. Language is in the hand of the creator. He doesn't feel it until he breaks it. When he throws it down, he hears the voice of language, the language that is his." In other words, for a poet working within his or her language, it is entirely permissible, if not necessary, to deliberately break the normative rules of language and language use. This breakdown will happen anyway over the course of time. And yet for a translator to subject an original text to this kind of damage is unpardonable. But if we can accept that an author resorts to damage in the act of writing, why are we reluctant to concede that a translator may do so as well? If an original author resorts to violence against language in order to access or release its authentic and personal unholy noises, as McSweeney stated, damage directed to an original text in the act of translation may be one way to avoid an entirely different kind of violence, the violence of domesticating a text in a target language, of forcing it to behave and abide by another language's linguistic, cultural, and social norms. Christian Hockey, and his poem is the second page of the handout, is a poet who divides his time between the US and Germany. And he set out to explore the relation between translation and violence in his borderline hybrid translation, Ventracle, which was published in 2010 by Ugly Duckling. You can see now Ugly Duckling has been very active in these, in publishing these kinds of translations for the last almost 10 years. The title is a portmanteau, a play on the English word ventricle, and the name of the German expressionist poet Georg Trakl, who was born in Salzburg, Austria in 1887 and died in 1914 in Krakow at the age of 27. Trakl's poetic output may have been slim, but the poems he published in his lifetime established his literary reputation for decades. During World War I, he worked in a medical unit under considerable stress. And his experiences at Grodek, a village in southern Poland, were particularly harrowing. And reportedly, Trakl attempted suicide during his service. His poem Grodek is considered to be one of his finest, and it's also the poem that Haki strives to translate on his own. This goal, this translation of the poem Grodek, motivates the entire project. Haki knew absolutely no German when he undertook the task of reading and translating Trakl's poetry. But Ventracle isn't concerned with literal or proper translation, but rather with exposing and articulating the work of translation, the brutal, violent work of translation. And to this end, Haki was partly inspired by Cameron's unorthodox strategies of translation, as he indicates in his preface to Ventracle. He pumped poems in German through online translation engines, translated homophonically by sound, isolated colors and recombined them to create poems like Yellow Trakl and White Trakl, or let pages of poetry decompose for months in water, translating just the words that surfaced. Haki also took the law of translation into his own hands. Wielding a 12-gauge shotgun, he stepped back 10 feet, shot in an open book of Trakl's poems, and then in his words, translated with a dictionary a remaining page of perforated text. So using the original poem as target practice is an extreme method, but what kind of translation does it ultimately produce? A number of the poems of Ventracle, like in Cameron's The Flowers of Bad, are made up of the kind of bizarre juxtapositions and verbal fragments that McSweeney described. They're strung together to create texts that offer an intriguing assortment of images and language, and the effect is inspiring but also disorienting. Where is the translation happening? Where and how does it emerge? Whereas Christian Haki's Ventracle is explicitly and transparently engaging the brutality of the process of translation, Sawaku Nakayasu's Mouth Eats Color, this is the third page in the handout, is an articulation or performance of the gray area between translated and original texts. Nakayasu, a published poet, is also a highly regarded English language translator of Japanese poetry, particularly the works of the Japanese modernist poet Chika Sagawa, who died young in 1935 of stomach cancer. Mouth Eats Color wouldn't be possible without the translations and the process of translating Chika Sagawa that Nakayasu has undertaken over many years. But otherwise, it bears little relation to Sagawa's original Japanese poems or to any idea of a kind of proper translation. Nakayasu's own translations of Sagawa's poems are not particularly experimental, so the collection isn't even a reflection of Nakayasu's typical translation practices. But what motivates Mouth Eats Color is an entirely different way of making translation happen, which Nakayasu describes as follows. The thing that becomes important to me about this whole process of engaging and interrogating translation is that it frees me to be more expressive about the various things I see going on in Sagawa's work. Sometimes I have the desire to combine several poems into one, to shed more light on either or both. There is a promiscuity in it. Once I break the one-to-one contract, it allows for multiple relationships." End quote. Calling these texts anti-translations, Nakayasu splices together lines from Sagawa's poems in both their original Japanese and her English translations, as well as bits of Chinese and French, including poems and translations by other authors. But Nakayasu's own writing is also a part of this mix, thereby blurring and confusing any notion of a single author or single translator. Instead of borders and bounds, Nakayasu introduces the promenade, or puromenado, variations on the same poem, which I give you a little sample of in the handout, that wind through the book like a broken perimeter. The reader is not expected to be able to read all of the text in the various languages from which and in which it is composed. In fact, I think Nakayasu prefers that you not know all of the languages. Nor does Nakayasu expect the reader to make sense of it. The point of the book, as she puts it, is to push through the idea of the book, to read each line as, in her words, modified, crushed, loosed, unprotected order. There's also an interesting backstory to this book, because it was inspired by a dare issued over Facebook. Nakayasu has said that most of the collection was composed over the course of a week, as she and a bunch of other poets were sort of discussing this issue over Facebook. But that realizing that the book didn't fit neatly into any category, she decided to start her own imprint, Rogue Factorial, which, in her words, develops and produces books in a roguish manner. So in conclusion, at the end of Entrakel, Haki offers, as an afterword, an English translation of Trakl's poem Grodek. How is it possible, after almost 150 pages of ludic, experimental, and disobedient translation, that Haki ends with a translation that is outwardly so proper and faithful, so seamless? Is it possible that all that talk of mischief and rule-bending was nothing more than talk? Not at all. Faithful Grodek is there to remind us that a proper translation is never what it seems, to cast suspicion on all the respectable translations out there, to keep our guard up and pull down our defenses at the same time, to make us think about what is going on in a translation the way we're trained to do so with original texts. In the words of the poet Meir Wieseltier, or rather in the words of his translator Shirley Kaufman, to spit on it, kick it, wring its neck. In other words, to read, write, and translate violently without restraint and see what emerges after we've spent some time willfully or by force in the extremes. Thank you.
Well, wait, okay. I've put quite a lot of stuff on. Can that? We don't need it on, do we? Thank you. Thanks, Rosie. Great. I put quite a lot of stuff on the handout. I'll tell you why this idea came into my mind first. As Matthew suggested, I've written some poems, and some of the poems were fake translations, but real poems. And this isn't, like most paradoxes, it looks like a paradox until the point where you look at it and you realize it isn't at all. It's totally logical. And I invented a Romanian poet who I put into a book of poems that I published about 3 years ago, called Liviu Campanu, and what prompted me to think about this whole idea was that I had done it for a perfectly natural reason, namely, I thought it would be quite interesting to imagine oneself as somebody else and see how much more of oneself one might express, actually rather a lot more, because as Adriana mentioned fleetingly, the whole idea of the mask is that we ask the wrong questions about the mask. We always wonder what the mask wearer is trying to hide. But if you flip the question, you very quickly realize that the mask wearer is in fact trying to show something, and that wearing a mask in literature, as in real life, enables you to do a number of things that you might not otherwise do, and which are perhaps even more yourself. So I wrote a series of poems by a fake Romanian poet. One of the reviews, in fact, there was a kind of theme in the review saying, oh, the McGinnis poems, it's just the usual stuff. He writes about death, Belgium, and other universals. But this this Romanian guy, he's the real thing. And it, despite the fact that I had flagged up the fact that he was invented, people didn't realize it, and then one reviewer said, I really like these Campanu poems till I realized they were fake. And I thought, what an extraordinary thing to say. You know, the poems weren't fake. Campanu didn't exist. I was only doing something that people do regularly in fiction and which no one complains about. And the poems, in a sense, exist. They have their identity, regardless of who allegedly wrote them. So I then looked with renewed interest at the whole tradition of fake translations or translated heteronyms. And we know about those things, and I'm going to look at a number of them now. But I suppose the first thing I wanted to say is that, again, Adriana said it just now, there's a whole series of metaphors seem to coagulate rather unpleasantly around translation to do with wreaking violence, being unfaithful, straying from, staying close to. They're metaphors of various kinds of distance, ethical distance, emotional distance, geographical distance. But all of them are pretty uninteresting as metaphors, and that's why so many debates about translation end up saying the same things. It also struck me that whenever one writes a poem, one is already, in a sense, becoming a heteronym of oneself internally by imagining what one would write if one were a poet. Now, that isn't a translation in any useful sense, but it seems to be quite logical that poets need to invent other poets, that the attraction of writing a translation that has no original can be quite profound, and that, in a sense, that whole... One of the other metaphors, of course, that gathers to the act of translation is also the implication of parasitism. But if you can imagine the fake translation as the parasite with no host, the translation with no original, then it actually can become quite interesting. So I stuck a quotation up there from C.H. Sisson, who was a rather miserable and uptight English poet who did a lot of translation. And he called his own translations fishing in other men's waters. And I quite like that idea, you know, that you go into these foreign seas and you go and catch their fish. And what interests me also about that is that I don't know anything about maritime law, but I imagine that there's all sorts of laws pertaining to who can fish where, what they can catch, net size, and so on, which can quite interestingly be projected onto translation and translators. Someone coming up to you and saying, oh, you don't know the original, might translate as, you're not allowed to use boats that size in this particular strip of water. Oh, you have got this particular tonality wrong, or you've got this word wrong, might be, you're only supposed to catch cod today and not herring, and all of this kind of thing. So all of those implications are there, quite interestingly. I'm not going to go into the way in which translation might resemble fishing. But it does take me quite interestingly to my first fake poet, who is in fact a fisherman, called Andreas Karavis, or Karavis, who's a fake Greek poet invented by a Canadian poet called David Solway. I suppose what I also want to suggest, all the poets that I'm going to look at, David Solway, Derek Mahan, Christopher Reed, and Michael Donaghy, if I have time, are poets who are trying to do specific things with the fake translation. One of the things I think they're trying to do is to become more themselves. But they're becoming more themselves, and they're interested in becoming more themselves, essentially by becoming less themselves. I think they're all poets who come from, quite obviously, a culture of huge surfeit, huge power, namely the English language and its accumulated traditions. And they come from these all in their different ways and create invented poets for, I think, quite culturally specific reasons. Now, up on the top here, top left, is Andreas Karavis. And what I also want to be absolutely clear about, of course, is that none of these fake translations are hoaxes. I'm not interested in the whole Earn Mali, Adore Flupet tradition of the hoax, because the hoax usually is a form of parody that is there to kind of show the culture up. This isn't what's happening. This is an attempt to introduce something into the culture while also making the culture look at itself more questioningly. Now, Karavis doesn't exist. And up at the top there, is the author photograph of David Solway's first book of Andreas Karavis's poems. The man in the photograph is in fact Solway's Montreal dentist, of whom he took a picture and stuck on the inside of his book. I don't have the Karavis poems here, but I do have this kind of parasite, which is the Andreas Karavis companion, edited in inverted commas by David Solway, with a few interviews with Karavis. They hunt him down, they find him fishing, he's a fisherman, and it's got all sorts of things like his letters, some of his juvenilia, and it's beginning to become a little bit like a novel. And some of it becomes quite tongue-in-cheek. And what I think is happening here is that Solway is trying to regain some sense of the elemental by going back into an imagined sort of elementalism which he projects onto onto Greek poetry. And called upon to justify himself, he writes this: Karavis is not a hoax in the usual sense. My intent is not deflationary in the tradition of Harold Stewart and James Macaulay's Erin Malley. I am not interested in perpetuating a deception, but in creating a style. And what Solway had been doing for the previous years was inserting, placing, publishing Karavis poems, usually without the knowledge and consent of the editors of magazines, in the magazines themselves. So the whole build-up, which is happening, as it were, extra-literarily, off the page as well, as some kind of humming backdrop. Have you heard of this Karavis man? And then he actually does a launch for the book, where he actually does have his dentist come in, look a bit grumpy with a little Greek sailor's hat, talk to nobody, smoke a lot, and then leave, in order to create the persona of Karavis. And then they all say, God, that was Karavis, the Homer of the 20th century. And he allows all of these things. So, of course, it does become a bit hoaxy, and I think by the end, this is the hoax. But I think that the first collection of fake poems is totally authentic, paradoxically. The editor of the Atlantic Monthly, which ran some Karavis poems, replied to various detractors who had said, you can't publish these things, you fooled us. And he says this: why is it so important that another name was used? What should matter, it seems to me, is whether the poems contain vitality and have identity as poems. Now, this is really obvious, but it's quite interesting because it opens on a larger question. A name isn't an identity, it's just a name. And the idea that the poem itself and conveys identity rather than the name, the poet and its attribution, is both obvious and quite unobvious. If you locate the identity of the poem in it and not who wrote it, you've got a different sort of question coming up, a sundering of author from text that's actually far more interesting than pretty much anything literary theory has come up with in the last 100 years. Where does a poem get its identity from? Its author or itself? And Solway's book of Karavis poems is enjoyable. It's not terrific. You want it to be better because, you know, by the time you've got it, you think, God, this could be so good. And he goes on too long, like most things that are good, and he doesn't always know when to stop. But it's clever and it's interesting. And this is the first Karavis poem. I am the one who speaks, a voice become your voice, as you read aloud or silently, tracing a course with your finger. Yet I am spoken by another, whose voice I cannot hear, whose recitation escapes me, whose language is adrift in dark, uncharted waters, even the shark and dogfish avoid. I am the channel between one I cannot hear and one I cannot see. I am the exile in the desolate margins, the sentinel on the coast. I stand by the broken jetty, the sun turns me to salt. So, this poem is obviously, I think, about its heteronymity, its fakeness. So if the mask is a form of ventriloquism, the translated mask or the fake poet would be a kind of ventriloquism or paraventriloquism. And lots of his poems are very sort of earthy and watery, and the poem seems also to be about translation, a voice become your voice, something spoken by another. And then in his introduction, this is where it gets a little bit arsy, because Solway translates this into Greek and offers it as the original. So you could see it can become a bit silly, like a comedy sketch that goes on too long. But it's a profoundly interesting thing to do. After this, Solway went on to invent another two poetic pseudonyms, translated poets. And you see that for him it's become a mode, almost as if he's now lost himself in these invented poets, the way a novelist might lose himself in a series of first-person narratives, which are both hit, both the novelist and not the novelist. Something that seems to me actually much more interesting and much more fun is Derek Mahan, who invents an Indian poet called Gopal Singh. Mahan's recent 400-page collected comes out in 2011 and takes us right up to his then latest book, An Autumn Wind. An Autumn Wind ends with a sequence of poems by a Hindi poet called Gopal Singh, but Mahan doesn't include Singh in his collected poems, bizarrely, even though he should, as they're actually his, completely his, and there is a sequence of them, and instead he opts to include them in raw materials, his book of translations and adaptations. And already I think that idea of raw material, you know, one guy talking about fishing, someone else talking about raw material, the rawness, perhaps the original is the raw and the translation is the cooked, and all this kind of stuff. Mahan is incidentally obsessed with raw and cooked. So what's going on? He leaves real poems by a fake poet out of his own collected, but in fake translations into his book of so-called real translations. And the title, as I said, Raw Material, says something about perhaps mining, the poet, the translator, mining for raw material, with a kind of undertow, I think, of parasitism, exploitation. Why choose an Indian poet? Why choose a Hindi writer? Why invent one? Well, we'll see. And this is what I also mean about these poets. All of them are kind of clogged up in a culture of surfeit. And these invented rawnesses, you could say, Caravis with his ships and his fish, and Gopal Singh, and Christopher Reed, Katharina Brack, and Michael Donaghy's invented Welsh poet. All of these are attempts, I think, to escape partly that culture of surfeit. But there are many other things besides. Gopal Singh, we're told, was born in 1959 and lives in Delhi. His poetry, says Mahan, is densely intertextual. Where have we come across that before? Mahan is densely intertextual, textual. All of Mahan is in fact obsessed with the fact that there is almost nothing left to write. Even early Mahan reads like late Mahan. And by that I mean that he is a poet who seems to have arrived, unlike, say, Longley, and specifically unlike Heaney, at a culture which he understands to be already full, crammed. His obsession with the fin de siècle, continuing obsession with the fin de siècle. The way he is already writing in his early poems about how there's almost no space left to write because everything's been said, every feeling has been described and notated. Densely intertextual and frequently references, this is Mahan on Gopal Singh, the work of others, with the result that it almost reads like a telescopic anthology of the contemporary Indian canon, but his own distinctive voice, we're reassured, is unmistakable. That's what Mahan wants to be, yeah? Except he wouldn't just want the Indian canon, he'd want the whole lot, everything. Ireland, Wales, Europe, Wales, not Wales, Ireland, Europe, England, America. He wants it all in there. What does he say about the translation process? It's very funny. He says this, Gopal Singh provided literal drafts for these rather, you can see that here, for these rather free versions and approved the results. I would like to thank him for his help and forbearance. Much has been lost in translation. Also, Ireland Literature Exchange for its support. He's clearly taking the piss there, isn't he, out of the idea of loss in translation and this totally ironic Ireland Literature Exchange, which exists, I looked it up. And obviously it's phantom support, because they're not translations. Unless, of course, he's even cleverer than we think. He actually got some money for this by pretending and so on. Now, this could read as something rather arch and postmodern, and we know Mahan doesn't really believe in postmodernism as such. He simply says, memorably in one poem, that he's hung around long enough for the old stuff to come back again. There's a little riff on the translator's fidelity. Much has been lost in translation. But the riff is even more kind of sort of tuneful because if there's nothing in the first place, nothing can be lost in translation. And I imagine that Ireland Literature Exchange, who are a real arts organisation, are coming in for what I assume are unreal thanks. Now, Gopal Singh is really a recycled Mahan, and in fact there's a lot of poems in Gopal Singh's oeuvre about recycling, but Mahan was already about recycling, so it's re-recycling. To talk about recycling, cultural and material surfeit, is to render one of Mahan's own greatest and most sustained obsessions. He's obsessed with what? Rubbish, trash, junk, scraps, cast-offs, lost things. He writes about a clutter essentially in search of a context. He also knows that a culture's dustbin is the double of its library, and its disused shed is the forgotten twin of its museum. And recycling is, of course, a form of intertextuality. And in Hangover Square, as I said, he talks about the forest of intertextuality in which he's caught up. I want to just have a quick gallop through the Mahan Gopal Singh. A child of the forest, and I think I stuck the word intertextual there because Mahan himself has a phrase about the intertextual forest. A child of the forest, our own city slums, dinner, clatters, the cuit, the cru, the cooked, the raw, dal simmers on cow dung fires, samosas fry beneath tangled wires. Something when I was reading this, I thought to myself that there was perhaps a sidelong dig, if that's the right word, perhaps an affectionate one, at Heaney as well. The idea of this kind of local life, that all you need for your poetry to be global is this plot of land into which you dig. That is the exact opposite of Mahan, of course, who is obsessively global. A shack in the woods and a few bamboo sticks would do, but I keep coming back to life, whose blaze darkens the stars. There he goes, there's a bit more like that. Forest of billboards, he talks about there. Down at the bottom, the great wave, this is absolutely Mahan ventriloquizing. If waste is the new raw material, as they say, our resources are infinite on black beaches, carrion, grocery, sewage, wide open fridges, fought over by frenetic gull and crow. Tractors haul the wreckage, dead car and cow, balconies, splintered bits of bungalow, on the last rocks, some soapstone madurai, devotional figures, a post-tsunami sky. Raw material up next, slightly above it. The recycling of old shoes as raw material makes artwork of the contingent real. And then the next one, recycling song. Absolutely clear indications that we are dealing with simply a reimagined Mahan. What goes round? Throw nothing out, he says at the end. Recycle the vilest rubbish, even your own discarded page. Everything comes full circle. See you again in heaven some sunny evening in a future age. Now, you can make up your own minds about the quality of these poems, but I find them slightly ambiguous, or rather I feel ambivalent about them in ways I might explain later. But there's a lot of cultural work, a lot of cultural anxiety going on, as it happens, in this Mahan, in this Gopal Singh. The inability to let go, really, of this kind of globalized intertextual choking surfeit that we call a culture. Something different is happening with Christopher Reed's Katharina Brack, published by Faber in 1985. If we stop for a moment and think about the context, we're 4 years from the end of communism, but not quite in Glasnost. UK poetry magazines have been translating East European poets with varying degrees of skill by poets and translators, often celebrity ones, often working from prose literal texts, which they then turned into nice, shiny poems. I'm thinking specifically of Marin Sorescu, Holub, Zbigniew Herbert, Brodsky. Tate Hughes called this period a unique tidal wave of poetry translation that swept through English in the 60s and 70s, so as if it kind of reinvigorates it. And it's certain, I think, through Poetry Review and especially Modern Poetry and Translation, that we received into our language a number of important poets of communist Europe. But this isn't what Reed is trying to do. It's very hard to tell with Reed because he's pretty inscrutable. But I think there's a number of things going on. One, ex-Martian poet has realized that you can't go on looking for new estrangements without making them familiar. And two, a backhanded homage, I think, to Anglo-East European translation culture with its various travel lines and its well-meaning appropriations. And three, I think something much more interesting, an attempt to bring out what we might call translatedness, matness. I think in terms of the shiny and the matte. I think Keravis and Gopal Singh are shiny because they're written, invented by essentially shiny poets who will always be shiny and can't imagine turning their hands to matness. However, I think matness is something that Reed is trying to do for various reasons, some of them aesthetic, some of them possibly ethical. And also, it's almost as if he... First thing is that he doesn't claim to be a translator. The book is simply called Katharina Brack, with Reed signaled as author. And there's a picture of her, you can see that. Now, already the picture does all sorts of things. Black and white, cracked picture, looks like it's been folded, put in the pocket. It's absolutely oozing East European closed society. And I think he is also trying to get across translationese and translatedness. If you look at the back of the book, it says this: "The testimony of Katharina Brack may strike readers as typical of the artist under pressure, but the way in which the still too little known poet addresses her situation remains startlingly individual. In presenting a selection of her work, Christopher Reed demonstrates his awareness both of the translator's special responsibilities and of the paradox whereby a poet must become the creation of his or her translator." Again, slightly arch, but also quite helpful. And I think, you know, the book of poems gets across this sense that Reed is avoiding anything that might be sparkly or shiny or appropriative of exactly the kind of thing that the poets who were translating from prose trans originals were doing before him. Trying to capture that awkward maladroitness of translation and reminding us too, at an ethical level, that we cannot simply, as English speakers, expect the world to fit into our language. It's as if he's interposing a layer of muffledness, as if to say this wasn't in English, so why should I pretend it was? It's also a meditation on the way in which the state and politics perhaps also muffles us, and the book has a running theme in it of hearing and overhearing, not hearing, of stopped speech, wary observation, hyper self-conscious, careful speaking. It feels very kind of closed in. There's almost no margin for movement in the book of constantly being circumscribed at every point, the point of exit as an original as well as the point of entry as a translation. It's an incredibly clever book, and it's the opposite of the Mahan, I think, which is also clever but perhaps too clever. Mahan, as I said, wants to be shiny and Reed wants to be matte, and you can see this from the way he Right. Now, I'm not really going to go into that, and neither am I going to talk about the Michael Donaghy fake Welsh ones, but they're interesting too, from that point of view. What Donaghy, I suppose, is calling back, again, by inventing this Welsh poet, Sean ap Brydydd, he does this thing as well that the novelist often does with invented characters, which is attach them to real characters. So Sean ap Brydydd didn't exist, but he was a contemporary of Dafydd ap Gwilym, who did exist and whom we know. And there's lots of quite good things going on here, and this speaks to a particular cultural moment as well, for which Donaghy was generally well known. He writes this poem, if you go a little bit further down. For example, a recent computer analysis of a hiraeth, his 30,000-word description of the interior of a heron's egg, has revealed two columns of slant rhyme weaving through the text line by line in a perfect double helix pattern. How such a poem could have been written under such exacting formal constraints is a puzzle. Why it was written is a positive enigma. And he's better known for his 30-syllable englynion. But my sense, anyway, right at the end, in the winter of 1360, Sean was beheaded for the crime of adultery. And here are some of his englynion. And I might suggest that here, the fake Welsh poet, invented by Michael Donaghy, who was an extremely skilled formal poet, American, who settled in England, and was an absolutely remarkable, but not necessarily showy, craftsman, and became, deliberately or by accident, the kind of figurehead for a sort of revival in poetry that we might call poetry that rhymes, scans, and makes sense, and is like the best kind of speech one can have. Donaghy and a number of his, I don't want to use the word disciples or acolytes, a number of his friends and those who appreciated him saw this very much as a stand against the kind of poetry coming from what we loosely call the Cambridge School, that is to say, poetry that is, I don't know, I'm not even going to try to describe that sort of poetry. But at this particular moment in the British poetry culture, that is to say, the 90s, between, say, what we mean by tradition and what we mean by postmodernism and so on, and what we mean by craft, come along. And the extremely tightly rhymed englynion system, the Welsh verse forms, cynhanedd and englynion, are, I suppose, ways for Donaghy to insist upon form and to create another poet through whom to express not just the pleasure of inventing a new poet. What's interesting about Welsh strict meter is that actually it doesn't tend to rhyme, well, it doesn't rhyme on line ends, but it actually has a very almost mathematical system of internal sound patterning. And this care for craft comes, I think, at a particular cultural moment. All of these poets are inventing poets, inventing translations, creating poems that are real poems, but fake translations, translations with no originals, because they extend their range, of course, because they do things that they themselves either do or don't do to their own satisfaction, because they serve very particular purposes in the poetry culture of the time, and because in their different ways they are marking certain kinds of return. That's enough. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm slightly feeling these have been too such thought-provoking and full papers. Shall we have our break now before Kasia does respond?
That's a good idea.
Shall we have a quick break for drink? Because the idea is to make the event as conversational as possible.
It's a strange thing. That's
it all means something, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. I was sort of horrified that they reissued it in sort of the generic.
That's right, the generic flavor. I know.
It's ridiculous.
Would you like some orange juice? Wine, red wine?